Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, Talk Radio for Fine Minds, airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern, and is always available for your listening pleasure at HallieKasserJane.com. Thank you so much for joining me. I am Hallie Kasser-Jane. Today on the Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, joining me at my table, are former militant jihadi turned undercover agent, Movement Sheikh, and psychologist Dr. Anne Speckard, co-authors of a fascinating new book, Undercover Jihadi. But before we begin, a brief message from our sponsors. You are listening to The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, talk radio for fine minds. The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show is always available online at HallieKasserJane.com and a host of venues, including Blog Talk Radio. But be sure to visit us at our newest home on iHeart Radio. Today, the Hallie Kasser-Jane Show is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. If you want to listen to it, Audible has it. With over 150,000 titles in virtually every genre, you'll find what you're looking for. Get a free audiobook and 30-day trial today by signing up at www.audibletrial.com/The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. Movement Sheikh was born and raised in Toronto, Canada, amidst 21st century Western values. His parents were of Indian descent and practicing Muslims, his father a founding member of their mosque. Movement attended public schools, but at night his parents insisted he also attend an Islamic madrasa. Cultures collided, and at age 19, Movement became a supporter of the militant jihadi culture. The 9/11 attacks prompted him to travel to Syria and study Arabic and Islamic studies, deepening his knowledge of Islam. A chance encounter with the Taliban in Pakistan, and then exposure to Canadian extremists, took him down the wrong path. He eventually relinquished his violent interpretations of Islam and volunteered with the Canadian Security Intelligence Service to fight international and domestic terrorism. Working for CSIS, he infiltrated several radical groups and conducted surveillance on suspects as an undercover operative on cases which remained classified, eventually working with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and the Integrated National Security Enforcement Team. He went undercover with and was instrumental in prosecuting Canada's largest domestic terrorism investigation, known as the Toronto 18 case. He spent 4 years testifying in 5 legal hearings as a fact witness, resulting in 11 admitting their guilt. He remains one of the very few people in the world to have actually been undercover in a homegrown terror cell, and his fascinating story is the subject of the book Undercover Jihadi, co-written by Sheikh and psychologist Dr. Anne Speckard. Let's talk. So, Mubin, this really is one of the most fascinating stories I've read in a very, very, very long time. I mean, I couldn't put the book down. I got to tell you, that's the truth. You were born and raised in Toronto. You called yourself a brown-skin kid in a sea of whites, into a world in which two different cultures were living uncomfortably side by side. And I have to tell you that when I read your description as you, as brown, that thought personally had never occurred to me when I looked at one of my Indian friends. But you did see yourself as different and felt different. Talk to me about that.
Well, I mean, of course, the idea of, you know, what you look like as opposed to what your citizenship might be. You know, there is this, assumption that in order for you to be Canadian, you got to be white because that's the majority culture. But I don't say it in the sense that I felt discriminated against or picked on or bullied. I personally didn't go through any of those experiences. I, as far as I was concerned, fit right in.
What's it like to be raised a Muslim, at least by your experience? I'd venture to say, and I said this to you off air, that very few people in the Western world have actually spoken to a Muslim. You know, Muslims are not everywhere in this country. I'm talking about America at this moment. I mean, talk to me about, are the tenets of the religion all that different than Judaism or Christianity? Are the moral lessons, aren't they the same?
Yeah, I mean, of course, according to some narratives, the Muslims are around every corner, right, waiting to take over. I mean, you're right. I mean, of course, it is the same Abrahamic message. It is the idea of the one God, that he sent, prophets and religious scriptures associated with those prophets. So in that sense, it draws from the same tradition. In many respects, Islamic law is very, very similar to Jewish law. But of course, what you're seeing today in the more extreme manifestations, or if you want to call it literal manifestations from, you know, 1400 years ago, that's the differentiating point between Islam today and Judaism in particular.
So here's where I want to go with this. I find all of this so fascinating. Let's talk your childhood a little bit, because we are the sum of our parts. And what happened to you is in relation to what your childhood was like. You grew up in a Muslim home. Your father was very, he started the madrasa, didn't he, in your town?
Yes.
Okay. And you have a sister, right?
Yep.
But life wasn't so wonderful in that little family enclave of yours. There were some uncles who took advantage of you. Talk to me about that childhood of yours.
Yeah. I mean, I'm okay to talk about this. I mean, I've reconciled it in my head, and it's a long time ago, and I'm in a different place now, of course. But when I was young, 10 years old, 11 years old, there were relatives who, sexually abused, molested not just myself but my sister. And this was a part of my childhood history, which, and I talk about this in the book, that this is really what invigorated me with a sense of righting wrongs and seeking justice and fixing what was broken and preventing others from doing these things to other people. So that was a part of it. There is, of course, a social conservatism that came with it, especially from the Indian background from which I come. There is a particular level of conservatism that may not be found in even Arab cultures. Some Arabs are very strict. Others are not so strict. I came from a strict background and quickly learned that religion, for example, in the madrasa system that I grew up in, although my father started it, I mean, he became busy with other things and really wasn't around to see, some of the clerics would beat the kids when they were younger. And so this introduces the idea of religion and violence, and religion being a violent experience. So this was also another aspect of what I was growing up in. Of course, juxtapose all of that with, by day, going to public school, open environment, multicultural environment, boys, girls, everybody, mixing freely, and then having to go back into this rigid, closed environment when the school day was over.
Yeah, and I would think that you have to split in a way, because there's the one world when you go to the public school, and then there's the other when you're going to your classes at the madrasa at night for religious studies. How'd you reconcile that in your little head, your smart head, by the way?
Well, I mean, I don't know how I really reconciled it. This is a period where it lays the foundation for an identity crisis to form, in my opinion. And I say this out of hindsight, because eventually what ended up happening was an identity crisis manifested very severely. And so I don't think I reconciled it. I think in my head, as I was growing up, this was just a period to absorb what I was seeing in my life environment, and deciding which and how much of each culture I would bring into my own self to make my own identity.
And do you think that that happens to a lot of Muslim kids, who, particularly in North America, where they may have whatever it is that comes with the family on the religious basis and the conservative kind of basis, versus, the crazy Westerners? we as a culture are a little bit wacky. Do you think that that's a common theme that you could apply to everybody who might at some point become radicalized? Is that a theme?
Most definitely. Identity and identity conflicts are one of the most common factors that we see when we get to psychoanalyze individuals like myself who go through this process of becoming extreme. And ideology is actually another point. I think in many cases, identity is actually the result of ideology. So if you're growing up as a Muslim kid and your paradigm is framed according to your religious values, then the idea of seeking belonging, seeking meaning, that is all consequence of your religious views as well. So I wouldn't be so quick to separate identity from ideology.
Well, that's an interesting point, and well taken. I want to talk to you about your mom, and I want to talk to you about women, because you're extraordinarily normal throughout all of this, despite everything that happened. And when you came of that age, girls looked interesting to you.
but you weren't supposed to touch. When all of that went on with the sexual abuse, you did go to your mom with that. She wasn't there for you. Was that part of the culture?
Yeah, I think it is a part of the culture. I think we even see this attitude in Western, where it's like, you know, it's hushed up. You don't talk about it. What are people going to say? How am I going to be perceived in my cultural community? And, you know, we see this across the board. This is something, especially when it comes to whether it's domestic abuse or sexual abuse by relatives. And I mean, these are the facts when it comes to sexual assault. You know, stranger rape is actually not very common. It's actually people you know.
Right, sure.
Do these things to you. So, you know, in that sense, I understood that my mother was helpless to do anything about it. As much as she was in anguish over it and would have liked for something to have been done, I can see that in her context, there wasn't really much she could do.
Okay, so here's a kid who grows up in a pretty conservative home with great moral education, right, and moral ways, as other than, you know, these uncles. What went wrong?
Well, I would say, okay, so what happened to me was, while I was growing up with these values, I was still forming my identity. I was still trying to see, you know, what values are going to resonate with me, which ones am I going to internalize and make a part of my, you know, my paradigm or my outlook. And what had happened was, and I mentioned this, of course, in the book, I had a house party when I was 17 that I got caught, and my parents were overseas, and my dad had told my uncle to check on the house. And of course, the day that I had this really rocking party, my uncle, you know, not one of the molesters, of course, he came up the front door, and I was busted. I mean, red-handed. And what happened was, they made me feel extremely guilty about what I had done. And the only way I could figure out how to, you know, fix myself, so to speak, was to become religious, because I knew that they valued the religious manifestation. They looked down on, of course, the Western culture and the activities that I was engaging in, even if they weren't really, I mean, drinking or drugs related, just the idea that you're hanging around non-Muslim kids, you are going to receive non-Muslim values, therefore it's a threat to our value system, therefore don't hang out with them. And this is what I was inundated with. And so in my desire to absolve myself of the guilt that I was experiencing, I concluded I needed to get religious. And that's what begins to set me down the road towards extremist thinking.
Can we talk Islam for a minute? I want to understand what I know that my listeners need, maybe some education, because I do think that we are very uneducated in this religion. And I mentioned that before, but I want to go a little bit deeper into this. First of all, you do remain a practicing Muslim, correct?
Oh, yes, of course.
Right. Is Islam a good religion that teaches good values? I mean, talk to me about the teaching of the Quran and the supporting texts and what you learned as a kid. I mean, is it inherently a good religion? And if it is, why have so many misinterpreted its teaching, including you?
Right. So the Islam is very similar to Judaism and Christianity. I mean, you know, I've read the Bible multiple times, the Jewish Bible, the New Testament as well. And the message is consistent. The idea of one God, helping the poor, helping orphans, being righteous, things of this nature. The Quran is situated in a 22-year period, 10 years in Mecca and 12 years in Medina. And, you know, a lot of things happen in that time. I mean, when you compare the New Testament, it's only 3 years of Jesus' ministry. Jesus, peace be upon him. We say peace be upon him after mention of all the prophets. So when you have to compare, you have to look at a situational attribution. I mean, the Jewish Bible has, you know, centuries of wisdom and teachings and history, and it has violence in it. I mean, when people ask, you know, if you want to know about the history of war in the Middle East, read the Bible, okay? So you have 22 years of the nation. It comes in a period where the polytheistic tribes begin to fight with the Muslims because, you know, their idea of one belief, the Abrahamic God, and they're fought because of this. And so you begin to find verses which legitimize fighting against those people. So the problem is, today people look at those verses and they try to make sense of it. They try to make sense of what's happening in the Muslim world. They see that there are Western invasions. Sometimes, you know, they're good. Sometimes they're not good. And they try to explain this, and they try to say, well, how how do we make sense of this? And when you go to the Islamic sources, you will find these verses that were revealed during a time of political conflict. So as soon as you come and enter into another period of political conflict, you are going to have people refer to those verses. So really, and just to close this point, this is why we make the point of mistaken interpretations, because I'll give you a perfect example. Chapter 9, verse 5, kill the unbelievers wherever you find them. And a lot of people they hate Islam and Muslims. They want to believe that Islam is the reason for it. They want to avoid, the reality of sociopolitics. They see that and they say, look, here's what the verse says. And this is funny because I used to believe the same thing until the scholar said to me, well, do you normally begin reading at verse 5? Right?
Right.
So if you go to verse 1, it tells you that this is in regards to polytheists who had broken the peace treaty between them. If you look at verse 4, verse 12, it talks about, it absolves those who were not engaged in hostile acts and does not include those people in the verses that talk about fighting. So there is a context that needs to be respected.
And then you get into this, and Christianity, and I suspect Judaism, you mentioned, like in the Jewish Bible, an eye for an eye, but Jews don't do that anymore. And Christianity is filled with all sorts of things like that. They don't do that anymore. So what's happening in Islam that they haven't let go of what clearly was written so long ago that it's really not applicable today? Is there a conversation in there?
I think this is the root of the problem. It is the literalistic readings of the Islamic sources. And there are two reasons for this, I think. Number one is ideology. I mean, the Islamic sources themselves talk about extremist groups who will emerge, who will quote the Quran, but it will not pass their throats. Okay, so this idea of literalistic readings, superficial, shallow readings, is castigated even in the Islamic sources. Okay, so the people who engage in this are following a particularly ideological bent, which allows them to read verses historically, which ignores contexts, which, ends justify the means. Types of argumentation, which is, of course, it's prohibited in Islam. You cannot, if you're not allowed to eat pork, let's say, you're not allowed to sell pork, okay? So these, you have these overtly Islamic groups who, drugs are illegal in Islam, but they involve themselves in smuggling drugs, right?
Right.
And the second point after ideology is dictatorships. I mean, you have dictators who have kept the people dumbed down for so long. These are dictatorships that have been secular and Marxist in their backgrounds. And in fact, this is where a lot of the anti-Semitism in the Muslim world is traced from. It's a vestige of the Marxists who were promulgating these ideas. Yes, there have been, negative history with interactions with Christians and Jews, but there has actually been a lot of good experiences with Jews and Christians. When you look in Muslim Spain, of course, there are hundreds of years and there are going to be good times and bad times. But this is the point. So that's why I think people, they haven't been able to move away from ancient interpretations.
So interesting. Sharia law, for those who don't know, that is what fundamentalist Muslims' concept of how to live their lives, right? Would that be a fair way to say it? I mean, you probably can say it better than I.
Yeah, I mean, the Sharia is understood to be the juris corpus, all right? The legal tradition that is associated to the Islamic faith. It is like the halakha in Jewish law. And it's very similar, the rules on, divorcing women and inheriting property. And one of the reasons why the, Jews don't practice the more austere laws is because the temple was destroyed. There are no sacrifices at the altar anymore. And so if that was not the case, then you would be seeing this kind of Jewish Sharia, if I can call it that. But the Sharia itself, even in Islamic teachings, there are five principles to it. It talks about protection of property, life, genealogy, religion, so on and so forth. It's very similar to what we have today as our legal system. So for example, the Sharia talks about objectives, right? So protecting property is the objective. But of course, in a desert culture 1400 years ago, when you took something, you had your hand cut off, right? That's the way that people lived. And this is the problem today. Muslims don't seem to understand that you don't need to necessarily chop off people's hands to achieve the objective of protecting property. Now we have imprisonment. You may have, counseling. You may have restorative justice principles. Now, these are modern concepts, which, we've come to, but the Muslim world has not. A large largely because, I think, because of ideology and dictatorships that have kept people dumbed down. It's because of our education that we've come to this place. Just a quick point, for example, stave off the corporal punishment by the raising of doubt. Okay, this is another principle of Islamic law. This is very similar to Western criminal law when we talk about beyond a reasonable doubt. So there are objectives that are congruent with Western principles. It's just the howness of it that we have a serious problem with.
I think that's a point that needs to really be punctuated, because maybe we shouldn't be blaming the people of the street who are getting a lot of the blame so much as the leaders who, to control whole parts of their society, are holding the thumb of, the hand of wrath over their people. Yes?
Well, of course. I mean, military dictatorships, what are they known for, right? It's oppressing the people. It's, the people live in very austere, depressing, humiliating environments. This is why we succeed the way we do in developed nations, in Western nations, because we don't have to worry about that. We don't have to worry about being disappeared by the security services because, you're trying to launch, some kind of political, opposition to the government, or pursuits in science. I mean, these are countries which all their money goes into, holding on to power. It doesn't go into studying science, philosophy. I mean, this is what the Muslim world was known for. All this golden age talk, the ideas, that informed Western enlightenment, a lot of them came from the Muslim world. And because the Muslim world has stopped studying science, philosophy, contributing in that regard, this is why they are where they are.
So I want to take it to this point. Often cited is that Muslims are motivated to terrorism because the Quran and the Hadith tells them that fighting non-believers is a duty of every Muslim, and the only way to be certain of going to heaven, to enjoy untold sensual pleasures, is to die fighting in the cause of Allah. And if a Muslim can make it to heaven, we Westerners hear this all the time. One of the rewards are going to be their 72 virgins. What's this concept of martyrdom? And is this myth to be dispelled? And let me just say this to you, Mubin. You can see why Westerners at this point, considering 9/11 as well, are terrified of Muslims and may not, from our point of view, be looking at Islam rationally either. Talk to me.
The idea of martyrdom, this is, again, something that's common in religion in general. The idea of dying for a higher purpose and you receiving special rewards for doing so. Islam is no different in that sense. I mean, it talks about this, and especially when you refer to the Quran where these conflicts started to happen, verses were given to encourage people to go and fight because it was a small community. They needed to motivate people. So one of those motivations is, yes, you will, if you die in the sake of God, in the path of God, you become a martyr and you receive these special rewards. And one of those rewards, stated rewards, is this idea of what have been described as virgins. But the Quran actually talks about these are basically, if I can call them, extraterrestrials, okay? In the sense that the Quran says that they have not been touched by angels or humans. They are almost like protected species. I don't know. They are humanoid in form. They are associated with sensual pleasures. Yes, this is true. And this is one of the rewards given to men in particular, because men are the primary audience in the Quran. Women have asked this question too. They're like, well, what do we get? Right? And really, the Quran says, look, whatever you want in paradise, you get. And so, I see it as, in that time, it's talking to men, so it's talking about sensual pleasures. It's talking about a desert-dwelling people, so heaven is described as having a lot of trees and gardens and rivers and streams. So these are things, I think, to encourage people to take on belief and to commit themselves beyond what people are generally willing to commit.
To my mind, when you're young, you don't make decisions as readily as you need to or as smart as you might when you're older and a little bit more seasoned. And all religions, be it Judaism, Christianity, be it Islam, the Abrahamic religions, it seems to me that they're all filled with a whole lot of stuff that may be metaphorical even, may have been true at one time and now is not. I wonder, though, why right now it seems that approximately 23% of the world's population is Muslim, which equates to about, 1.6 billion Muslims worldwide. Currently, the latest incarnation of this militancy, this fundamental nature of the religion, is ISIS. And I was trying to find figures on how large their army at this point really is. moving, and I come from one that says 20,000, another 30,000, up to 200,000, I've been told. That's 23% of the world population, and the number of recruits to ISIS, while not massive, certainly is significant. And I'm wondering what the hell is going on here, really.
Fair question. I mean, we have to look at, again, sociopolitical context. I mean, ISIS didn't just obviously drop out of the sky. They are a direct result of particular consequences of Middle East invasions. Now, I want to take two points to this. One is to keep in mind, there's a difference between explanation and justification. So when I say that, you know, the war in Iraq laid the foundation for the creation of ISIS. In particular, what you're dealing with now is ISIS is largely staffed at the highest echelons by ex-Saddam Baathists. Okay, so this is the Saddam government coming back to take over again. And the reason this happened is because after 2003, when the Sunni Saddam government was deposed, a lot of the military, intelligence, police, and police individuals lost their jobs. They were basically laid off and sent home. And the Shia government was then brought in because the majority of Iraqis are Shia, and the Shia government took over. Now, the Western troops that had been using the Sunni tribes to fight Al-Qaeda, they were suddenly being killed off by this Shia government. So this Sunni power base then turns away from the government, turns to Al-Qaeda in Iraq to regain their power that they've lost. This is the bare bones of what ISIS is about and where they've come from. However, aside from just the Western, military invasions in 2003 in particular, there is ideology. There is the ideology of what is called Salafi jihadi ideology. And this comes of Saudi Arabia. I mean, this we have to trace back to the late 1800s when the British went in, trained some of the Arab tribes to fight the Turks who had control over that region. Brits were, of course, fighting the Turks at that time. There was a whole thing with, you know, World War One, World War Two alliances, World War One alliances, and gave rise to this country called Saudi Arabia. And you had basically desert Arabs who suddenly came to power. The Wahhabis, who were the religious types at the time, one validated the other. And so because of Saudi Arabia's oil boom, you have billions of petrodollars that have been used to push out this very literalistic, shall I say, Bedouin-type Islam throughout the world. And so these are the things that have given rise to what we're seeing now.
Okay, so you, having gone through something pretty scary for parents to watch, obviously becoming radicalized, found your way. God bless you, right? Allah bless you. Why? Well, you met one man who started to talk to you in a different voice and got you to listen in a different way. That was your experience. What happens to all of these people who are out there by the tens of thousands? They can't meet that one sheikh who was so wonderful to you. What do you say about that? How do we stop this? How do we control this? Can we?
Yeah, of course, right now there are, I mean, the vast majority of Muslims completely reject what ISIS stands for. I mean, it's one of the reasons why ISIS kills other Muslims is because those Muslims are speaking out against them, especially in Iraq and Syria. Man, I mean, we have the comfort here in the West to speak out, to condemn, to say all these things. But over there, I mean, they will come and kill you. They will kill you and they will kill your family. They will blow themselves up in the mosque that you pray in. So over there, it's very difficult. And you have Muslim fighters who are, you know, keeping ISIS at bay, at least in Syria. These are Muslim groups, religious groups, who are fighting both Assad and ISIS at the same time without much support from the West or even from the West. And I mean, they're getting more of the support from regional countries who are there. So what we can do about it is to promote or to at least support those mainstream Muslims that oppose ISIS, that uphold the concepts of, you know, justice, the idea of, you know, relevant interpretations and not seeking to replicate, you know, 7th century Arabia Bedouin culture. This is, I think, the way forward. And of course, this is a testament to the West. A lot of these great thinkers are products of the West. Me, myself, I can say, you know, I subscribe to this ideology and whatnot and all these stories of foreign fighters and Westerners. We cannot escape the fact that we are products of the West. And so I think that the way forward is for the West to understand that you will not achieve any kind of victory, tactical or strategic, by declaring this to be a war on Islam. We need to work with those Muslims who are fighting ISIS. who are opposing this extremist ideology. And that is the way forward.
Okay, so let's get off that track for a second. Let me just go back another track, because I think that there's also this issue, which is you have to get to kids like you were younger and be also aware of what's going on, because I think you were putting out a lot of signals that all was not wonderful, thank you very much, and nobody was catching them. And I think that's a lot of what's going on with some of these recruitments that they're making. These are kids, just like in America, where we've had all these, you know, crazy gun shootouts, where every single one of these kids who's done this in our schools was a known problem child, and nobody did anything about it. And I think that that exists in this situation as well, don't you?
Absolutely. You know, when you look at a lot of these kids that are joining, you'll see that they come from overwhelmingly from broken homes. There's been some kind of dysfunctional family upbringing, feelings of inadequacy, alienation, isolation, whether real or perceived. And, you know, you have individuals who come from criminal backgrounds. It's like joining a gang. You know, whether that kid joins a white supremacist gang, white kid joins a white supremacist gang, black kid joins, you know, black urban street gang, or brown guy, coming back to, you know, how we started this off,
right,
or brown guy joining his brown gang. At the end of the day, it's a sense of belonging to the strong tribe, the idea that this tribe is going to protect me from my perceived enemies. And it explains why, you know, how do kids watch beheading videos and think that this is okay? Because in their worldview, and if you just juxtapose an urban street gang situation or a white supremacist gang, who stands around watching somebody get his skull crushed at the bottom of someone's boot, right, and cheer it on? And kick the guy in the face too. I mean, it's the same kind of environment, this group violence, mob mentality, the idea that we're striking at our enemy and our enemy is hurt and this makes us feel good.
Here's something that fascinated me in reading this delicious, wonderfully well-written, well-told story of yours in Undercover Jihad. And that is, there are a lot of kids like you who had a lot of crap go on in their lives, right? But they don't all become radicalized. So the question that I wanted to ask you, as much as any question that I wanted to ask you, is what's the trigger, babe? What's the deal that we haven't discussed that makes one turn that way versus the other not? Have you thought about that? Have you thought about what it was that triggered it in you? Because if you know what that trigger was, I bet you that trigger is the same for a lot of the other kids who are out there who turn, you know, the wrong road.
Yeah. I think this is what internet-based radicalization is all identified as an aggravating factor. The reason why an individual will, if I could make it so basic, that will move from talk to action is from an emotional context. So a kid who is sitting at home watching jihadi videos all day long is watching scenes of oppression, humiliation, killing. He will be moved to action. So, for example, Joe White guy who's in, you know, South Carolina, when he sits at home watching these videos and he begins to think that the suffering that I'm seeing, I am now a victim of that. Because when you sit there and you watch these videos over and over and over, I'm sorry. I mean, you try to do that to yourself. Spend an hour, just an hour straight watching these videos and watch and see what develops inside you, inside your head. The emotions that start to generate, anger, hatred, desire for revenge. These are the, I think, trigger points that move a person from thought to action. And when you start to view these videos in conjunction with ideological justification, so you're seeing these people being killed, then enter a religious guy, religious looking guy who comes in and says, you see what's happening here? This is because they hate you as Muslims. This is one of the arguments that the extremists put forth. They're doing this because they're a crusader coalition. You'll find that this is a very common theme when they go into this sort of stuff. So using ideological justification, using videos that can be disseminated, you know, across the world just by a click of the mouse, watching these videos again and again and again, this is what puts these people on that path.
Okay, so let's change subject real quick. Let's go to this one. Muslims and Jews, like oil and water. What's the story? Well, you actually were taught to hate Jews, and not until a trip to Israel did you begin to question that hate, but you did.
Yeah, you know, Jews and Muslims, this is a case of sibling rivalry gone mad. Really is. It really is. If you trace it all the way back to, you know, the biblical texts that mention the sign of the covenant, that was circumcision, which was done with Abraham and Ishmael, it links Ishmael into that prophetic lineage. I mean, the Bible talks about, you know, great nations will come from him, or whether it's the case of Isaac and, you know, the idea that Sarah couldn't conceive a child and Abraham married Hagar, had Ishmael, the sign of the covenant is done with Ishmael, then Sarah has Isaac, then there is the whole, you know, the Jewish covenant. And Muslims, I mean, the Quran teaches this, the vast majority and righteous people came from Bani Israel, the tribe of Israel. And Muslims believe that because the Jews rejected Jesus, they deviated in that sense. And the Muslims were, the Christians then became, you know, the true believers. And they deviated because they didn't accept the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And so the Muslims are now the selected people. This is the Muslim worldview anyway. So there is this competition between Jews, Christians, and Muslims, okay? Number two, the idea of hating Jews, this was really a product of secular Marxists. I mean, when you look at, you know, after the establishment of the State of Israel, the Arab fight against the Jews was not on religious basis. It was a very secular Marxist approach, the PLO, all these groups that emerged. Then you see the religious switches flipped on. You can then refer to some of the criticisms made of Jews in the Quran. I mean, the same criticisms that were made of Jews in the Jewish Bible even. So that is another component. And three, here I am. I'm hearing both things. I go to Israel. This is 1998. And I had a positive experience. And these things, you know, so I had a positive experience. I'm not Arab. I don't have this Arab fixation with Israel, right? This is where the Palestinian issue comes in. And it's a very real issue, of course.
Ultimately, you get it together. You go back to Canada. Lots of stuff happened. I don't want to give away the story of the book in total because I want everybody to read it. But I want to talk to you about your work as an undercover jihad. You joined forces with the Canadian Security Intelligence Service to fight international and domestic terrorism. Right? At great risk to you and your wife and your young children at the time, I believe, and your father, who had been the prominent member of the Muslim community. You infiltrated several radical groups and conducted surveillance on suspects as an undercover operative, ultimately getting in with the group that was became known as the Toronto 18. This part of the book, so riveting. I had to stop and remind myself I wasn't reading fiction. That's how extraordinary this was to me. But I want to talk to you about forgetting your experience. Now you saw it from the outside in, I should say, to somebody else's experience, to many people's experiences. How did that change how you viewed this whole problem that we have with these, you know, these cells, these terrorists? What did you learn most?
Well, one of the biggest observations was how similar to myself a lot of these individuals are and were. I could have very easily come under, you know, an active investigation, and maybe I did, and I still don't know about it. But what I saw was, you know, a mirrors of myself. I mean, other kids who are going through an identity crisis, relying on deviant ideology, doing the exact same things that I myself was doing. And it also taught me how well we do our work here in the West. I mean, you know, I'm sure, of course, there are demonization narratives of national security agencies. I mean, they're not angels. They're not Boy Scouts. I mean, you're dealing with bad people doing bad things or wanting to do bad things. But I was struck at how we get over backwards. I mean, we go out of our way to make sure that we meet the legal tests before we lay charges on people. We endeavor to a very robust legal system and judicial processes in order to assign guilt and to lay convictions. And so this is something that, in fact, made me relatively, you know, very pro-national security agencies, is that contrary to what people might describe them as doing, they don't go out, you know, picking names, Muslim names out of a hat and, you know, just haphazard decide to lay charges on people. I mean, they go after people because those people have been caught up in nets, you know, for a reason. I mean, notwithstanding the mistake or the innocent person, I mean, that happens. But the overwhelming majority of cases, you know, you're catching people who are up to no good, right? And even when it comes to, like, sting operations, It's no different than when, you know, they lure in a child sex predator by pretending they're little Lucy on the other line, right? But in fact, it's Agent Lucy Smith. And look, you just got caught. It's as simple as that.
Incredibly courageous. I have to give you credit for that, because you were in some dicey situations that you could have gotten caught and gotten God knows what happened to you. So, got, you know, my goodness, unbelievable. And that part of the story, everybody really does need to read, if not the whole book. But I want to say this. At the time then, when you were eight, when you it was time to turn these guys in and to do what needed to be done, you weren't so, you had to think about it, kind of went on a bender with drugs a little bit. I mean, it was not an easy thing to turn in a fellow Muslim, right?
Yeah, I mean, what started to happen was, here I am, and I have defined my self-worth, you know, against my membership in the Muslim community. And now suddenly I find the Muslim community, I mean, I start to get nervous. I start to get nervous that, oh my God, what are people going to say? What are they going to think? Are they going to understand? Are they going to accept that what I did was the right thing? And I talk about this. I was on a bender for like a good 6 months. I mean, and what was happening, I mean, this was after the arrest took place. There was a lot of hatred that came from the community, people who were, you know, wishing death and destruction upon me. And, you know, I fell into cocaine use. That was my drug of choice, largely because, you know, when I experimented with it in high school, I remembered that one of the things it did was bring your self-confidence up, or at least, you know, so you think. And because my confidence had plummeted, based on what had happened. So I was experiencing, we might call it PTSD. And it was very difficult for me. It really was. And I talk about this in the book, and I'm very open about this because, here I am in court swearing to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me Allah. I have to be honest about myself, about, you know, I had to be ready to give evidence against myself if I wanted to convince others to believe the evidence I was giving regarding those people. And, you know, it was a very traumatic experience for me, psychologically, emotionally, intellectually. But, you know, if I can say, it was a good experience because I learned very quickly who my true friends were. I learned very quickly what my real identity was. You know, no way was I going to let the haters have satisfaction of seeing me fall and not get up. I fell, I took my hits, but I got up. And honestly, if I hadn't gone through that level of darkness, I wouldn't have been able to appreciate the light.
I want to ask you now about how we are, you mentioned it briefly, but I want to go into a little bit more detail about how we're framing this situation and how we're dealing with radicalism. President Obama has been very dogmatic even in saying we are not going to call this a war against Islam, we're going to call it a war on terror. ISIS is not Islam. I want to ask you first what you think about that decision. And then I want to ask you if there's a problem of glossing over a certain reality that will serve no one on either side of this whole thing in the long run. What's your thought?
The truth is always going to be somewhere in the middle. I agree with President Obama in not using that term, and I'll tell you why. You know, first and foremost, we do not want to give ammunition to the terrorist narrative. We cannot tell ourselves that we have to counter this group and then isolate and marginalize the entire Muslim community. That's a non-starter, because you need the Muslim community not just to feed you intelligence, but you need them for undercover operations. And in the Middle East, you need them to be your allies on the ground, boots on the ground in particular, against ISIS. So it will not achieve our objective of defeating ISIS if we engage in the same rhetoric that they engage in. I do training for military agencies. I mean, I'm very involved with NATO and Special Operations Command. I'll be attending their conference in New York at the beginning of April. And the point is this. You don't have to believe that Islam is a legit religion. You can believe whatever you want to believe about it. But at the end of the day, if we are to fight the enemy, then the enemy that is ISIS is hostile to both Muslims and non-Muslims. So it follows that we need to ally with Muslims who are anti-ISIS. And that's the majority of Muslims you're dealing with. Moreover, the whole idea of we do not want to get into a war on Islam narrative. I mean, we don't want to do that. Because we've been through that. I mean, you know, there was a whole period of the Crusades, and it wasn't good for anyone. And the biggest mistake we can make, especially we're fighting a war, okay? We're fighting an insurgency. We're fighting a social movement, okay? This is not, it's not so easy. We must make use of allies in the Muslim world, because it is the Muslims right now that are fighting ISIS in Iraq and Syria, especially in Syria. And it's being done by, you know, Jordan, by Turkey. Those are two, you know, Western allies. You have other regional players, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Lebanon. You know, they want to participate in the fight. So I think we need to let them do that. And if they feel that they're perpetuating a war against Islam, they will lose credibility among their local populations, and especially in the war zones in which they're going to be going.
But is it fair to say that whether you like it or not, it's just like Jews saying the, you know, the ultra orthodox, they kind of look at them like they're, you know, regular secular Jews look at the ultra orthodox as like, what are they? That you have to look at these fundamentalists as part of Islam, because to deny that, is that fair?
Right. So what the term that I use is TICs, okay? Terrorists in Islamic costume. And this uses the term Islamic in a fair way, and it uses the term costume in a fair way, because one, it acknowledges that it has something to do with Islam. I mean, they're not quoting the Bhagavad Gita or, you know, the Torah. Another scripture. They're right. Quoting the Islamic scriptures. Okay, this is a fact. But the argument is they cannot be Islamic, because the things that they do are blatantly against Islam. For example, quick example, the use of child soldiers. The use of child soldiers is completely prohibited in Islam. The Prophet, peace be upon him, when there were young kids who tried to go and fight, some of them even trying to tippy-toe to make themselves look taller, he refused them participation because they were not adults, they could not make decisions, da-da-da. ISIS uses child soldiers. Boko Haram uses child soldiers. This, you cannot say that this is Islamic. I'll give you another example. The caliph, the original caliph, Abu Bakr, in his exhortation to the Muslim soldiers, he said, "Do not kill women and children. When you come upon people who are in monasteries, leave them alone. Pass them by." Now you have ISIS that is driving these people out of monasteries. You have churches that have been in the Muslim world for hundreds of years. Nobody destroyed them. The Muslim rulers that were around for hundreds of years, they didn't destroy them. But here comes this group, suddenly they're destroying them. So what we say is that, in fact, what they're doing is the opposite of Islamic teachings. And this is why the majority of the Muslim world oppose them and fight them, laying their lives down in that cause.
Okay. What about the Muslim community? Why isn't leadership collectively standing together on the top of rooftops or someplace and just shouting, "Stop the madness"? I mean, you said that you want to see more comprehensive development by Muslim leaders with government backing. I'm so glad to hear you say that, but embellish that. This is one of my biggest beefs, and I've had Ayman's on the show, and et cetera. I don't understand why, seriously, you don't hear somebody get on the White House front lawn if you need be, and just say, okay, this is enough. We're all going to work together, and we're going to stop this. Why not? Why hasn't it happened?
Yeah, there are a number of issues that are with this. Number one, I mean, I maintain that the vast majority, they have condemned ISIS. They have condemned these groups. You know, on one hand, they don't get coverage. Okay. Number two, you have people who, you know, who preach very superficial understandings of Islam. So, I mean, this whole idea of taqiyya, okay, this is a concept that has been spread out that Muslims, you know, are allowed to lie. And so, you know, so this creates a second problem, is that demand Muslims speak out, but when they speak out, people say, oh, well, it's taqiyya anyway, right? So it creates an impossible standard to meet. A third issue is condemning terrorism will not end terrorism, just like condemning violent crime doesn't end violent crime, okay? Another point is that, let me just say, I do believe that more needs to be done, okay? I will say, for example, in Tunisia, there are thousands came out to oppose terrorists after what happened in the museum attack. In Libya, I mean, in the beginning stages, when it's unfortunate NATO just walked away from it and kind of let things break apart. But NATO, I mean, Libyans were out in support of NATO fighting against Gaddafi. When one of the terrorist groups committed an action, they marched on to, I mean, these are unarmed civilians. And they were shot at, of course, by the terrorists, some people being killed. In the West, I would like to see, Muslims come out in droves, in big numbers, protesting. And it does happen. I don't think there's enough of it. And even when it does happen, there's not enough coverage of it. So this is what I mean by amplifying the voices of those Muslims who stand in opposition to ISIS and other groups. I mean, there are Muslim groups who are working very closely with government. I mean, of course, on the other side, some people accuse them all of being, Muslim Brotherhood infiltrators. I mean, you got to be realistic. At the end of the day, if you're making the claim that the top levels of your national security agencies have been infiltrated, well, then you've lost. Okay. So you need to people need to get this out of their heads. Listen, I mean, the American establishment, the institutions that are there, don't think for a second that they're going to let people promulgate views which are not consistent with the American interest at home and abroad.
Yeah, I just do think there could be, and I'm going to listen to this word I'm going to use, it could be a kumbaya moment. If you could get rabbis, imams, and, whoever else up there together, and everybody collectively say, we are in this, this is not religion. This has been hijacked. So it's not just the Muslim leaders. It needs to be, I think, everybody across the board to make it work. If the world is becoming saturated with all of this, just animal behavior, beheadings, my God, it's just bizarre, right? I mean, it's like back to the dark ages. Do we stand a chance to win against these barbarians?
Well, we need to be consistent with our values, I think. We also experience radicalization. After the attacks of 9/11, we started to think torture was okay. So we need to be careful we don't become the very monsters we're trying to fight. And the reality is that we are fighting monsters. I mean, like you said, not just beheadings, but burning people alive, crucifying them, hanging them from bridges. I mean, these were things that were done very long ago in the world. The way to defeat them is to remain consistent with our values. Giving due legal process is very important. I believe, I'm a big believer in that. I sat through public prosecution for 4 years, 5 legal hearings, giving testimony, and I saw the way in which we, exercise judicial processes, evidence. We're very fair and very just in the way that we approach this, and we need to stick to that. This, I think, is the most important thing. It can be done, I mean, but we need to be aware of our limitations. Pushing a button and thinking everything can just be disappeared by bombing them into oblivion, that's not a solution. I mean, you have General Stanley McChrystal, head of special operations for a time, General David Petraeus, they both said, you cannot kill your way out of an industrial-sized insurgency. So there is a role for fighting, but there is a role for the public narrative, and this is something that I invest in, the public narrative. It doesn't have to be a kumbaya thing. I mean, if you want to think about it from military psyops, psychological operations, it tries to do the same thing. It informs and influences people's behavior by putting forward a narrative that resonates among the masses.
D, all of the above, right?
Yeah, a little of all things. Some things need to be turned up in particular contexts. Other cases, not so much. Like, very quickly, large-scale military invasions by the West is not going to do it. Ground invasions by Muslim countries that are, directly impacted, that will do it. The West has competencies in special ops and intelligence. Those are things that they can do, right, to augment others doing their share of the work.
I've been speaking with Mumin Sheikh, the co-author of Undercover Jihadi, available on Amazon.com. For more information on Mumin and his work fighting terrorism, visit www.undercoverjihadi.com. Dr. Anne Speckhard, the co-author of Undercover Jihadi, is an adjunct associate professor of psychiatry at Georgetown University Medical School and of Security Studies in the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. Dr. Speckert has been working in the field of post-traumatic stress disorder since the 1980s and has extensive experience working throughout the world. She's the author of Talking to Terrorists, Fetal Abduction, and co-author of Warrior Princess. Dr. Speckert is a frequent contributor to the Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. Let's talk.
Okay, so Anne, welcome back to the Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. It's always nice to have you here, particularly to discuss the extraordinary story of Movement Shake, so wonderfully written by the both of you. And for the sake of full disclosure, I did write a blurb for this book, folks. I gave it my thumbs up. I want you to all pick it up and read it. So Anne, his story is something else. His journey to militant jihad, how typical path do you think his was?
I think it's pretty typical, actually. Very typical. I mean, here's a guy that has been hurt early on in life. Well, the madrasa is kind of strange in the West, that he went to madrasa as a young child. And just falling in with a crowd of kids that, you know, young adolescents and a bit older, that were into militant jihad, and he just went for it. It resonated with the things that were hurting inside.
When I was reading the book, I mean, what you lay out for the reader is that there was a perfect storm of events for him. And I wonder in the collective, in all of these guys who wind up doing this, if that would be probably true as well. I want to punctuate and further our conversation down that road.
Well, my view is that any violent ideology has to find its hooks inside of the person. So there's got to be something that's hurting inside. You know, it's not just about politics, that you're angry about the political situation, therefore you're willing to go off and join a militant jihadi group. There's got to be something else inside that it resonates to you. It gives you a positive sense of identity. It gives you belonging. It gives you an outlet for anger that you maybe have about other injustices, things that happen to you, but now you can generalize that to a broader cause, and you can just let all your anger fly out of you.
Well, you know, Movement and I discussed his childhood and the various, you know, pieces of the puzzle that came together to put him forward on this. But, you know, there are a lot of people just like him who have very similar backgrounds who don't make the choice. And I asked him about that. I was curious as to what you think is the trigger, the difference between a person who does go down this bad route versus one who doesn't, given the same set of tools to work with in life.
Well, again, it's exposure, you know, what you're exposed to, how you try to heal yourself. And there's as many hurts as there are in the world, there's as many ways to heal. But if a group, if you're exposed to a group and it offers you an outlet for your anger, then that can be very powerful. Whether you pick it up or not, you know, it's an individual choice. And Mubin was already, you know, kind of going the tough guy route, so that fit with the identity that he was building.
Okay, so that choice then is what versus those who do, and there has to be a specific there, because the story is told a thousandfold over and over and over again. And if we could map that trigger piece, maybe that would give us some answer as to how to stop it before it even gets there.
Well, the trigger piece may be exposure. I mean, think about it. I lived in Belarus, and Belarus is a terrible country. They live under a dictator, but they have a long, long history of being repressed. Stalin came in and took all their thought leaders and shot them point blank, one by one. And all the grandmothers have warned their children and grandchildren, don't fight back against your government, just be quiet. And they've basically learned to be rather dissociative in the face of things that are horrible. So here is a whole group of people that have all the injustices that another group of people is facing, and they do absolutely nothing. They don't go out in the streets and protest, and they don't become terrorists. They're not exposed to a violent ideology, and they've also been trained by their culture not to respond in that way. And in Mubin's case, he was trained to defend Islam, to be angry if it was insulted in any way. He was raised with a fair degree of violence in his Islamic teachings. You know, in the madrasa, they hit him. And he had a inner hurt that resonated to a message of hate. And then he was exposed to a group of guys that were into this message of hate. If he had never been exposed, he wouldn't have triggered.
Okay, that's a fair answer. I want to talk to you about religiosity. Religion can be like alcoholism and drug addiction and sex addiction. And for some, it's the same elixir. It's just religion versus drugs or alcohol. Does that play a role in some of this?
Sure. If it makes you forget what's hurting. I mean, think about it. If somebody's willing to strap on a suicide vest and go and kill themselves, and if they're believing an ideology that's religious, they can get the sense of euphoria that they get the euphoria because their brain is delivering opioids to them because they're about to violate the instinct to stay alive. But they can translate that all into religious euphoria. I'm about to go to paradise. And yes, of course, that plays a role, and it can be quite addictive.
Mubin admitted that having been sexually abused by his uncles, certainly part of the mix that led him down the road to radicalism. In fact, we can name all the bad things that happened to Mubin, or who happened to any of these guys who go off to fight with ISIS or become Al-Qaeda or do whatever the heck it is that they wind up doing to themselves. But I want to take this down to excuses. And I think we have to be very careful, at least I feel that way, about, yes, there are psychological reasons for whatever any of us do, I'm sure. But there can be also using the negativity in our life as an excuse to do some of the things that we may choose to do that aren't always the smartest choices we make. Is that fair to introduce into this conversation?
Absolutely. And whenever I look at terrorism, I look at it as a lethal cocktail that's made up of four things. There's a group, there's an ideology, and the ideology is always wrong because I don't care what your cause is. There's no reason that you should target civilians for it. So there's the group and ideology, social support, which is also often wrong, and then your individual vulnerabilities. And those four things come together. But yes, of course, it's always wrong to blame others and strike out at others for the things that are hurting in our lives.
Radical Islam, among the other things that it is a reflection of our times? Listen, hear me out on this. We've never been more connected than we are through social media today. And yet, I have to tell you, we're never as individuals that with all of that connection, that's also as isolated as we are behind our computers and behind, you know what I'm saying? So doesn't that isolation and loneliness make us more susceptible to becoming part of a larger group, to wanting to belong, to be part of something? And this world seems to me to be suffering, in a sense, from abject loneliness.
That might be part of the appeal to Westerners that are getting drawn in via social media. But for me, I see it much more that they're looking for a sense of identity and adventure. You know, that these are people that are off their life track. You know, when you look at their individual profiles, they're usually not doing real well. And here this group that they've been exposed to over the internet is offering them what looks like a real adventure, sometimes offering them love. I mean, there's love affairs that happen, like Shannon Connolly in Denver, who was Skyping with her ISIS lover. And, you know, if you fall in love, then you're totally blind
right
to everything else.
One voice made all the difference to Mubin, and he was lucky because he had that one voice come to him. But others out there, it seems like there's a mass madness, and one voice is not going to fix it all. Do you feel that mass madness?
I definitely feel the madness, but I've always believed that one person can make a huge difference. I mean, look at Martin Luther King and what he did with his nonviolent civil rights movement. One person can totally change a crowd of people. And that Sufi imam that spoke to Mubin, you know, God bless him, and may many, many more rise up like him that speak to the people that are misguided and following the ISIS ideology.
You're a psychologist.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We've talked to a lot of terrorists. The title, by the way, of one of your great books, Talking to Terrorists, a segment of the Hallie Cassar Jane Show for all of you who want to go and find that segment and listen to it. There are certainly criteria that you can name that lead people taking these violent paths. But I'd like to ask you something else. Why are some cultures, no matter how much the world beats them, able to rise above and accomplish and thrive, while others simply seem to succumb to blame and lethargy and even pick up weapons of destruction to be used in violence. It's as if they always see themselves as victims and they blame everybody else. Is that written into certain societies that needs something that needs to be addressed?
Every culture has its history and its story. So definitely, if the story is that you're always a victim and someone else is to blame, then that's the way you're going to be raised, and that's going to be your mindset, and you are more easily going to resonate to an ideology that tells you that's true. And every culture also has its ways of raising its children. So if children are raised to value education, if they're raised gently without violence, and raised with a hope and an optimism, then that's what they're going to go for. And we see that many times. We see that with immigrants that come over, and if their culture is that type of culture, suddenly their kids just take off. You know, it doesn't matter if they landed here in poverty. But if you're a culture that beats your kids and tells them it's somebody else to blame, those kind of people are going to go on a different path.
So if you apply that to Islam, and I think that there is a certain reality to that in Islam right now, not everywhere, but maybe in certain patches of it, the long-term effort to restructure, to stop this from continuing, no joke, could take centuries, no?
Not necessarily. I know in Sweden, they changed in a generation on how they raise their children. They just decided we're sick of child abuse, and they passed a lot of laws with teeth in them, and they changed their entire culture on how they dealt with child abuse. And most Islamic cultures have fallen behind in the last hundreds of years, and cultures that are, you know, third world and falling behind oftentimes aren't raising their kids gently, unfortunately. And think about it. If you open the gates to violence, if you raise your kids violently and teach them that violence is the way you solve problems, then certainly they're going to be much more open to these kind of movements.
So once they get lost on the path, the only way to stop them shy a miracle, which is what happened in Muba's case as far as I'm concerned, is bullets. How do we change that?
Well, it's not only bullets, but sometimes it's force to stop a person and throw them into a jail cell. And, the way to contain force is through force oftentimes, but then you can take a gentler approach and you can try to figure out what's going on with the person. And, you know, anytime you hold something over them to say you need to cooperate, you need to change, in order to gain your freedom, in order to gain more possibilities, hopefully you can see change. Some people will refuse to change, but others will be cooperative.
When I was thinking more in terms of ISIS, Al-Qaeda, large groups, you know,
we had 20,000 of them in the prison in Iraq, and they did, you know, they sorted through and they figured out which ones they didn't think would be amenable to change, but others were released, and I would have been all for working with the hardcore. I think that sometimes when you get people that are highly passionate, you can redirect them.
I've been speaking with Dr. Anne Speckhard, co-author of Undercover Jihadi, available at Barnes & Noble. For more information on Dr. Speckhard and her work, visit her website at www.annespeckhard.com. Before I go, I want to remind everyone that podcasts of current and past shows are always available to listen to free on iTunes under The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show is also available for download via Spreaker.com, Stitcher.com, BlogTalkRadio.com, and a host of other venues. Google The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show and you will find us. Of course, podcasts of our shows, both past and present, are always posted for your listening pleasure at HallieKasserJane.com. Which I hope you'll visit often for the latest information on our upcoming segments. Oh, and while you're at HallieKasserJane.com, don't forget to visit my blog to read my latest musings. I'll be back next week same time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for another edition of the Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, Talk Radio for Fine Minds, brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/ The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. Audible.com features over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Stay in touch, won't you? Remember, that's HallieKasserJane.com. Discover us on Facebook at HallieKasserJane and on Twitter at HallieCJ. I love to hear from you. So, till we meet again, this is Hallie Kasser-Jane. It's a wrap.